Life is difficult. Those are the first three words that M. Scott Peck wrote in his book, The Road Less Traveled. And I think this man would agree. His life has been dubbed the biography of failure. He lost his job in 32, decided to run for state legislature and was defeated. Started a business in 33, but it failed. He got elected to the state legislature in 34, but in 35 his sweetheart died. 36 he had a nervous breakdown. In 38 he was defeated for Speaker of the House. In 43 he decided to run for Congress, but he was defeated in the nomination process. He got elected to Congress in 46, but lost the renomination in 48. Was rejected for land officer in 49. Defeated for the U.S. Senate in 54, defeated for the nomination of vice president in 56, again defeated for the U.S. Senate in 58, but in 1860, Abraham Lincoln was elected 16th president of the United States. We all go through a lot of failures in life, a lot of difficulties, a lot of challenges. Always been so. Obstacles are a part of life. Some are minor, some are major. Sometimes they are of our own making. But if we want to move forward, we've got to keep on keeping on. And spiritually speaking, we must continue to press toward the heavenly prize. Our theme this week is pressing toward the prize, and it's based on Paul's statement in Philippians chapter 3, when he said, brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead, I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Tonight we want to talk about some of the obstacles, some of the problems, some of the challenges that we have to face as we run the Christian race and we seek to move forward. It's good to see each one tonight. We have a good crowd for a Monday night, and it's good to have you out. I know that each of you have had your own day of challenges and busyness and work and different things that's going on. We've had a good day. Wiley Airbnb with a good breakfast this morning, they said, Monday, we have eggs and bacon. Is that okay? I said, listen, I just try to blend in wherever I'm at. Eggs, I'll take it. I'll just, you know, that's fine. So it was all good, and had a good service this morning, I believe. And it's good to have those out that was able to be with us. And then Taylor took me over to Converse, and man, I had a good Indiana tenderloin sandwich. Man, it was good. I recommend you go over there. All right. Now, I heard in Kokomo there's one even better. I don't know if it is, that's true or not. But it was awful good in Converse. And we've had a good afternoon, a good day. And I wish I could tell you about tonight. We had a wonderful dinner, but there was a lot of stories that were told that I can't repeat from the pulpit. But I'll just wait and put them on blog. How's that, Denny? Did that work? But we've had a great day, and I appreciate your encouragement, your hospitality, and every act of kindness that you're showing toward us. I want us tonight to look at four major areas that we need to consider that can become obstacles to us if we want to run the Christian race in such a way as to obtain the prize. And I want us to begin right here in this text in Philippians chapter 3, because one of the obstacles a lot of times that we run into in being successful and pressing on toward the prize is the problem of living in the past. And Paul said, this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind. Now, we just need to be reminded again and again, as Jack Haver said, the past is a dead issue. You can't gain any momentum moving toward tomorrow if you're dragging the past behind you. That's true in every area of life, and it's certainly true spiritually. I love the plaque that Cyrus Curtis, who once owned the Saturday Evening Post, had hanging in his office, and he said, yesterday ended last night. Well, that's a good motto for us to remember. not to live in the past. Now, think about some things that the Apostle Paul had in his past that could have slowed him down and kept him from pressing forward toward the prize. There could have been the problem of past sins. You know, Paul said in one place that he was a chief of sinners. And everyone that knows the life of him when he was Saul of Tarsus knows how he held the coats of those that stoned Stephen and consented to his death, and how he breathed out threatenings of slaughter against the church, putting men and women into prison. He had letters to go to Damascus and further persecute Christians. And he said he did it in all good conscience. And yet here he had this hanging over him, all of these things that he had done in the past. And he said, but by the grace of God, I am what I am. And his grace toward me was not in vain, but I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God, which was with me. And so Paul's attitude, regardless of our past life, needs to be to put that behind us and to allow God's grace to work within our lives and to help us to move forward. Through the years, I've had a situation of talking with any number of people that have dealt with great burdens of the past and things that they have done that haunt their conscience and burden them with the issue of sin. And yet, if we're honest about it and we understand the promises of Jesus, we know that God forgives us, we can put it in the past, and that we can move on. In his best-selling book, Why on Earth Am I Here, he said we are products of our past, but we don't have to be prisoners of it. Steve Maraboli affirmed, he said, my past has not defined me, it has not destroyed me, it has not deterred me, nor defeated me, it has only strengthened me. And so that's the way we need to deal with the problems of the past. Put them behind us, not worry about them, not wallow in them, not bring them up, but allow God's grace. Well, Paul could have been worried about his past injuries by brethren. You remember he talked about how the people forsook him. He said, my first defense, no one stood with me, but all forsook me. But then he said, may it not be laid to their charge or charged against them. And so we probably have all had that sort of thing happen in our lives where someone as our best friend didn't stand by us. Someone maybe rejected us. Someone wasn't there for us during a difficult time. Well, Paul experienced that and he said everyone forsook him. But Paul wouldn't worry about that. That Paul wasn't wallowing in self-pity thinking about that. He said, I'll put that in the past. I'm not going to worry about that. Albert Cliff has neat little book, and just the title says it all, Let Go and Let God. Well, that's a good motto to have when we deal with some of these things in the past. Let it go and turn it over to the Lord. Well, another thing the Apostle Paul could have worried about was past thorns in the flesh. In 2 Corinthians in chapter 12, the Apostle talks about this thorn in the flesh. And he speaks of this thorn in a way that lets us know that it was a problem for him. He said that the thorn, and I begin reading in verse 7 of 2 Corinthians 12, he said, lest I should be exalted above measure, by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me above measure. Concerning that thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that he might depart from me. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I would rather boast of my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. And so Paul looked at this thorn. Now, of course, everybody wants to know, well, what was the thorn? And the commentator, there's a lot of different opinions. You know, some people think that it was some kind of a spiritual temptation. And then other people say, well, his thorn in the flesh was persecution. He had all this persecution. That was his thorn. And then others suggest that it was poor eyesight. You remember he wrote in one place, I think it's Galatians, that he'd written a letter with his own hand with such large letters. And that Paul had an eyesight problem, and that was his thorn in the flesh. You want to know what I think? I don't know. I don't know. It didn't really make any difference. But I know this. Have you ever stepped on a thorn? Or have you ever been working and you got a thorn in your thumb or in your hand? It hurts, doesn't it? It's pricking you. It is keeping you from maybe concentrating on what you need to be focusing on. And so whatever this thorn was, it was bothering Paul. And he prayed about it three times. Three times he went to the throne of God and prayed for the thorn to be removed. But God's answer was that my grace is sufficient for you. And my strength will be made perfect or complete in weakness. So what was Paul's attitude about the thorn? He said, well, that's fine. He said, I will gladly accept this thorn and I'm going to allow this thorn, which by the way, he didn't blame God, okay? He didn't blame God for the thorn. He put the blame right where it belonged, the devil. It's a messenger of Satan. And he said, I'm just going to turn this thing around and I'm going to use this to make me stronger and to make me a better Christian and more determined to press on toward the prize. G. Campbell Morgan said that what we do in the crisis always depends on whether or not we see the difficulties in the light of God or God in the shadow of the difficulties. And that is true. Paul saw God in the shadow of the difficulties and he forgot about the thorn. And you and I can do that too if we're not living in the past. Well, there's a mix by loved ones. You know, through the years I've been talking with people and people come for counseling and advice sometimes. A lot of problems that people deal with in the Lord's church have to do in their families. And it could be a husband or wife that someone feels like that has betrayed them or has harmed them in some way. J.E. Adams, in his book Christian Living in the Home, tells a story about a woman he calls Sue and her husband Wilbur that came to him for counseling. And she came in and she said, I got a lot of physical problems and I got ulcers and I got this, there are all things. And she said, they can't find anything wrong with me. But she says, I know what it is and it's him. And pointed to Wilbur. And then she threw down on the counselor's desk this manuscript, typewritten, single space, both sides of the page, there's about that thick. And what it was all of Wilbur's supposed wrongs over the past 20 years. Adam said he picked it up and glanced at it and saw what it was. And he turned to her and he said, ma'am, he said, I don't believe I've ever had anybody come in my office as bitter as you are. Well, that took her back a little bit. But he says, what you have here is not only a record of Wilbur's supposed sins and wrongs against you, but it's also a record of your sin. And that took back even more. And then he read to her 1 Corinthians 13, love keeps no record of wrongs. Well, she had not only kept a record of it, she had written it down and typed it up. And there it was. Now, I've never heard of anything before or since so absurd, but you know, there are people who got some pretty good memories. And they can tell you what happened 20 years ago or 30 years ago or when they first got married or someone that holds a grudge against their parents for the way they were brought up or against a sibling or somebody else, an aunt or an uncle or whatever, and they can't let go of it. And whatever those mistakes, regardless how serious they were, the Bible tells us, Paul says, love doesn't keep a record of wrongs. And so you've got to let it go. But there's one more I want to mention to you. And that's past victories. You know, I think about the Apostle Paul. We mentioned yesterday when we introduced this study that Paul was in a Roman prison. Now, you certainly understand that the prisons back then were not anything like going to prison today. That you didn't have any creature comforts or any luxuries. It could have been in something like a damp, dark kind of a cave or something. Could have been a hole in the ground with bars over the top. But it was not a very desirable situation. And so here he was in this cave. And he could have been a person that had become kind of bitter about this. But he could also become a person that the only thing he could think about doing was just thinking about how great the past was. Because his present wasn't very desirable. So he could have spent his time in his prison recounting his successes. His missionary trips. His sermons preached. His churches that he had established, the epistles that he penned, the preachers that he trained, the pastors that he appointed, the respect that he had earned of brethren and fellow preachers. He could have been sitting back, the great apostle Paul. Oh, those were the good old days. But he wasn't doing that. He said, I'm pressing on toward the prize. You mean in prison? You can press on toward the prize? Even when the circumstances are not ideal, when things seem against you, you can keep pressing toward the prize. Exactly so. And so our challenge is to press on and to reach forward regardless of good, bad, or in between and not be living in the past. The 19th century philosopher Soren Kierkegaard once said, but it must be lived forwards. And certainly that is true. So the first big obstacle we got to get out of the way if we're going to press on toward the prize is living in the past. The next one I want to talk about in a few minutes are negative attitudes. Sometimes we become our own biggest obstacle with a pessimistic, negative, destructive attitude that undermines our ability to press forward. This morning in our class, and we're doing a class for the 3 morning sessions on the ABCs of discipleship. So we're going to take 3 letters every morning. And so we took ABC this morning. And the A was attitude. And we talked about the importance of attitude. The Philippians 2:5 says, let this attitude be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. And so we discussed the attitude, the outlook, the point of view, the mental frame of reference, the way that we view people and things and situations and circumstances. And we only had about 10 minutes or 15 to talk about that point. And I don't think we got into talking about negative and positive attitudes so much, but there's all kinds of attitudes that people can have. You know, people say it's difference in the glass. Half in pessimist, it says, sees the obstacle in every opportunity, and the optimist sees the opportunity in every obstacle. And so there are people that have a negative attitude. Someone put it this way, they got the disease of I-can-itis. And no matter what it is, they got I-can-itis. I can't do that. I can remember as a kid growing up over in Hendricks County that I learned not to say I can't to my dad. He didn't want to hear about anything that you can't. And dad would come back, he'd say, can't, never could. Well, as a kid, I thought that sounded stupid. I mean, can't, never could. But as I got older, I understood what dad meant by that. And he really was saying to me that when you have a negative attitude and you're saying, I can't, then you're not going to be able to do anything. You're not going to be able to accomplish this task or whatever it is that's set before you, this class that you're flunking, or this job I gave you to do on the farm or whatever it is. Can't, never could. And that's right. Now, there are a lot of Bible examples. And you never know, I've been places where they sang for 30 minutes before I got up to. No, I have. I have. One congregation, every time I go, they sing for 30 minutes. And so, I'm not going to keep people a ridiculous amount of time. But you all didn't do that, so I got a little extra time tonight. See, you thought you'd get out early if you only had a couple songs, right? Well, the preacher's not going to look at it that way. He's going to take that time back and use it for himself. Now watch tonight, I have 30 minutes of singing tomorrow night. I didn't put this in your notes, but you all are familiar with Numbers 13 and 14. It's after the children of Israel has come out of Egypt and they journeyed to Kadesh Barnea. And it's taken them 2 years to get from the Red Sea now to Kadesh Barnea. And Moses sent out the 12 spies. You remember that? Just nod your head yes that you do. I don't have to explain. Okay, you do remember that. Okay, I thought you did. That's a pretty familiar Bible narrative. So the 12 spies are sent out. Now, do you remember about these 12 spies? If you read earlier in that chapter, these were chosen from the men of war. The great men of war that's in the book of Numbers. And I mean, these 12, these were not just picked out of a lottery. I mean, these were not, you know, some weaklings or something. We're going to stand in if they get killed over Canaan, we will never miss them. They were the best of the best. These 12 were the warriors. That's who they were. I mean, Numbers tells us that. And so these 12 were sent out. Now, do you remember the part of the story where they come back? And they come back with these grapes and figs, and they come back with this report about the land, and it's a great and it's a good land. You remember all of that? The cities are walled and fortified. But what does 10 say? The 10 said, we can't take it. There's giants in the land, and we were like grasshoppers in their own sight, and we're not able to overcome. That's what the 10 said. But there were two men that stood up against that. And they silenced Israel. And they said, be quiet, listen, we can do it. God is on our side. We are well able to overcome. Let us go up at once and possess the land. And you know what happened? It was those 10 negative, I can't itis spies that turned the whole congregation of Israel against Moses and Aaron. And you remember how extreme it was? It said in Numbers 14 that they stayed up all night in their tents murmuring. And the next day, they wanted to elect a new leader and to go back to Egypt because we had it good in Egypt. They were enslaved. At one point, they were making bricks and had nothing to make the bricks out of hardly. I mean, it's incredible. We want to go back to Egypt. Well, you remember what happened. God punished them. And only two of those spies entered into the land. You know their names, don't you? Don't you? Thank you. Do you know the names of the other 10? Now, you got to be a Bible trivia expert. You don't know the names of the other 10. They've faded into oblivion. We don't remember the failures. We don't remember these that said, I can't and I won't. And God's not there. But you remember Caleb and Joshua. And I'm in the wilderness, you know, you read all the different things. You know how many men of war died in the wilderness? Well, you're going to say all but two, right? You know how many that is? 603,548. You say, how do you know that? Because the book of Numbers tells you how many men of war there were. 603,550. And Caleb and Joshua were only two that made it. Now, when you are positive and you have got your goal and eyes set upon the goal to press toward the prize, you may be in a small number as far as the world is concerned, your community is concerned. And unfortunately, there's even been cases as far as some brethren may be concerned at times. But don't worry about that. Don't allow negative attitudes to hold you back and say that you can't do it. What you need to do is to be like Paul. And Paul said, I can. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. If we're going to press toward the prize, we got to get rid of negative attitudes. Negative attitudes that hold us back. All right? A lot more we can say about that one. Number six, behaviors that hold us back. And as I was studying for this lesson not long ago, I'm not sure how I came across this exactly, but I titled this way because of this article that was written by this husband-wife team, Mark and Angel Chernoff. They're authors, professional life coaches. They've been recognized by Forbes magazine as having the most popular personal blog development blogs. And so they coach people in life. So they had this article called 9 Toxic Behaviors Holding Good People Back. And they underscore that saying the quality of your behavior drives the quality of your life. Well, that caught my attention and I started reading these 9. I could do a whole lesson on these 9. I don't want to have 9 subpoints on this lesson. So I just picked out 3 of these 9, and all 9 of them are pretty much biblical. These 3 definitely are that we need to, but they're toxic behaviors that can hold us back and keep us from pressing on toward the prize. And one is just the idea of procrastination. D. Bowman used to call it put off itis. Put off itis, just putting off. And the Bible challenges us to do what it is we know we need to do and to do it now. 2 Corinthians 6:2 said, today is the day of salvation. Today's the day of salvation. And so regardless of where you are in your discipleship, and we talked this morning, the discipleship is not an event, it's a process. And so we're all on the road, we're all progressing, hopefully, toward that maturity and becoming more like Christ. Regardless where you are, you gotta keep moving forward. Today is a day of salvation. So you don't live in the past and worry about what you didn't get done yesterday. You can't change that. But you don't say, well, I'll do it tomorrow. Well, what if tomorrow never comes? And so we live today and give the Lord the very best that we have today. The wise man said in the book of Ecclesiastes, and he wrote about life under the sun. Life on earth as we know it now. There's a lot of great advice in the book of Ecclesiastes about getting things done and doing it while you have the time. One of them is Ecclesiastes 9:10. He said, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all of your might. When? Now? Right now? Today? And so the challenge of the Bible is immediate acceptance and obedience. Charles Goodall, that was one of our professors at Florida College, was known for his teaching on personal evangelism. And he wrote a little book entitled The Same Hour of the Night. And he believed in the idea, and I'm not here to necessarily promote this, but many times you can teach people the gospel plan of salvation in one setting, and he had this one shot setting to convert people. Now, my experience has been a lot of times it takes several studies to do that. But he believed, and take that expression from Acts, the same hour of the night. Well, you know, when I'm studying with people and I know they're ready to be baptized, I challenge them to be baptized the same hour of the night. Today is the day of salvation. Now is the accepted time. Don't wait. Don't put off. Don't say, I'll do it someday or one of these days. Do it now. But you know, that very same principle applies to all of us as Christians. You want to get started on a Bible reading program? You want to spend more time in prayer? You want to develop your teaching skills? You want to grow in some particular grace or virtue that you believe you're falling short in? You want to be more involved in evangelism? I mean, there are a myriad of things that we could talk about that you might want to improve or grow in. You know when you start? Now. Because procrastination is the enemy of success in every single endeavor. Paul said in Ephesians 5 that we need to redeem the time because the days are evil. One version translates that, make the most of every opportunity. And that's today. That is now. So stop saying, I wish, and start saying, I will. Get rid of the toxic behavior of procrastination. And then there is the behavior that they talk about of not taking personal responsibility or blaming other people. Now, do you know when that began? You do, don't you? In the Garden of Eden, you see, when Adam and Eve sinned and Adam was called into account for him eating the forbidden fruit, and that's when men started blaming their wives. Started with Adam, all right? And he says, this woman you gave me. But Eve wasn't going to let it stop there. Then she turned around and blamed the serpent that tempted her, and people have been blaming other people ever since, you know, and the devil ever since. You know, well, that won't work. And you go through the Bible. I mean, Aaron blamed the people for the golden calf and gagged the king and the ox and the sheep and all of that. And so that's been going on forever. And so we need to take a personal accountability and responsibility for our actions. Galatians 6:5 says that we are each responsible for our own conduct. We are each responsible for our own conduct, or every man must bear his own burden. We must take personal responsibility. And if we don't do that, that's going to hold us back. And then a third toxic behavior is relationship conflicts. And the authors talk about that a good bit. And I thought about a number of things that might fit into relationship conflicts. And there are a lot of relationship conflicts that we have. The Bible talks of some relational issues. One is the lack of forgiveness. And it just seems like a lot of people have a problem in forgiving other people. John Mason, in his books, expresses the importance of forgiveness this way. He said, living a life of unforgiveness is like leaving the parking brake on when you drive your car. It causes you to slow down and to lose momentum. Well, that's a pretty good analogy. George Mueller expressed it this way. He said, he who fails to forgive others burns the bridge over which he must walk himself. Now, that's just another way of saying what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. Because you remember what he said, and that if you fail to forgive others, that your heavenly Father will not forgive you of your trespasses. And you think about how serious that is. I mean, you have burned the bridge over which you got to cross yourself eventually. Because who of us can say that we're not going to sin anymore? And so we got this brother or sister that we got a grudge against, and we won't forgive them. And so are we going to be able to go the rest of our lives and never have to go to God and ask forgiveness? Now, if you're to take the words of Jesus literally there, and I personally do, then God can't forgive you if you have an unforgiving spirit. That you must get that issue, that relationship issue, corrected with the other person. That's a relationship toxic behavior that holds us back. And right along with that is the idea of ill will and animosity we may have toward our brother. And John, in John 4, 1 John 4 talks about the person says, I love God, and yet he hates his brother. How can a person say, I love God whom he has not seen, and hates his brother whom he has seen? I mean, those are in conflict one with another. And so this kind of ill will and animosity is going to hinder our relationship with God. And then along with that is all kinds of anger and wrath and bitterness. And Ephesians 4:31 said all that should be put away from you. Why? Because you've put on the new man. You've been renewed in the attitude of your mind. And so put all of that away and put it off. They're toxic behavior. They're going to hold you back in your Christian race every single time. We got one more major thing to talk about, and that's unfavorable circumstances. And there's all kinds of unfavorable circumstances that we got to deal with, and all of them have the potential, if we're not careful, in keeping us from pressing toward the prize. One, of course, is just personal circumstances. You know, there's an old story, and one of the preachers here may have told. In fact, it's so old, these young guys have never heard this, probably. That's how old it is. That's how old I am, okay? But there's an old story that preachers used to tell about the lady that was known to be very negative. In fact, folks hated at church to ask her, how are you? Because she would give them an organ recital. You get that? Okay. So one Sunday, she's leaving the building, and the preacher made a mistake, and he started to ask her how she was, then he thought better of it, and he just said, he made a mistake, he said, how you doing? He turned at the preacher with a look of resignation and whined and said, well, pretty good under the circumstances. The preacher hadn't heard enough of that for years. The preacher quickly said, he said, well, sister, what are you doing under them? Get out from under the circumstances. Well, there's all kinds of personal circumstances that we can say, and we've all got our, see, my circumstances are bigger and better than yours. See, right? Now, well, yeah, because I think my circumstances are unique, and I would do more for the Lord. I'd be more involved for the Lord. I would give more. I would pray more. I would study more. I would attend better. But, you know, you got to understand my circumstances. But you're going to tell me, well, hey, that's nothing. It's like a fishing story. Huh, you caught a fish. You look what I did. Listen to my circumstances. That ain't nothing. If you had my wife, huh, I tell you. If you grew up the way I grew up. Yeah. And so we all got personal circumstances. Well, tell me, brethren, what personal circumstances will the Lord accept for not obeying Him? What personal circumstances is going to please the Lord for us not being discipled and growing in grace and knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ? Can we blame our husband or wife or parents or children? Our financial problems, our lack of education, our health issues, our physical infirmities. Can we blame that, those circumstances? Paul said, I've learned to be content. What other circumstances? I know how to abound and be abased. Have little, have a lot. Suffer one, whatever. And I've learned to be content. Now, you notice there that contentment doesn't come naturally. He said, I've learned that. You have to learn it. It's not always easy, but that's the way you deal with circumstances in every situation. And we talked yesterday, I guess it was, about Paul's circumstances and being shipwrecked and imprisoned and beaten and stoned to death and all these kind of things. He had some tough circumstances, but Paul kept pressing toward the goal. And then there's societal or cultural circumstances. Some people want to blame the culture around us. We want to blame the world. We want to blame unbelievers. We want to blame the community. It's hard to be a Christian today. You know that? It's hard to live a good moral life. And sometimes if we're not careful, and I've done this, I know that our young people today face things that I didn't face when I was a kid growing up. Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet. We had three channels on our little black and white TV. We didn't have cable and didn't have our cell phones and iPads and iDis and all that kind of stuff. And so this stuff is piped in. And yet, you know, when you go back to Bible times and you see the hedonism and the immorality, and how bad society was, did you know that all but one of the Roman emperors was a homosexual? And some of them were pedophiles. I mean, surely you've heard them talk about the temple in Corinth where there were 1,000 prostitutes that prostituted themselves in the name of religion. And all the kind of putrid behavior, illicit and ungodly behavior that went on in the first century. And yet, in spite of that, that Christianity flourished in the first century. And the governmental authorities were unfavorable many times toward Christians. I mean, at best, they tolerated it in the first century. And at worst, they were like Nero or Domitian, and they persecuted Christians. And so when we look at our culture as being immoral, that we can't blame the culture. But what Paul told them, and he tells us, is do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life. And so that's what we need to do. In every generation, regardless of what's going on in society or in culture, that we need to be the light of the world and to be the salt of the earth and not blame the culture for us not being better and doing better. God expects better, regardless of societal or cultural circumstances. And then sometimes congregational circumstances. You know, preacher, I could move forward, but it's the church's fault. It's those preachers. If we had some good preaching, I think I could grow. If those elders would get on the ball, if we had better Bible class teachers. I haven't heard anything like that here because I'm hearing just the opposite here. What a great group you have here and good preaching and solid leadership. But you know what I've learned about that? That almost in every place, no matter how good the preaching is and how solid the leadership is, you're going to have a few that don't see it that way. Because it's easy to blame the leadership and the church for your lack of growth if you're not careful about that. And every situation is different. You know, this is a big crowd compared to a lot of places. When we go up to Canada in the summer, you know, all those churches right there in the Niagara region, there's about half a dozen of them, are 25 to 40 people. About equal all the brethren in the Niagara region practically. And yet they're not complaining about being small. They're not complaining about their circumstances in the congregation there. They're working and growing and loving each other and sharing the word and doing the best they can. And they're moving forward and pressing toward the goal. When I was a kid growing up here in Hendricks County, well, I better be careful because I might could end up naming some down or some. But there was a place that I went quite a little ways away from Hendricks County to preach. It was a small church. They didn't have a full-time preacher. Brother McKee sent me over there to preach for him occasionally. And it was a small group. And I was 16 years old. And I had all the answers. And I knew how they could grow. And so full of vim and vigor, I'm up trying to motivate them, encourage them to grow and do better. And finally, I'd done that a couple of times. A brother came up to me and he told me, he said, "Now, young man, I'm going to tell you something." He said, "We're small." Well, I was only 16, but I could see that. I mean, I could see they were small. But then he said, "We've always been small." Well, I didn't know that. And then he said, "We always will be small." Wow. What a vision for the future, eh? And so let's just blame that we're a small little group. And that we can't make a difference. We can't grow. We can't do anything. You know, Paul didn't give the brethren of Corinth a pass because there were church problems. But he urged them to be steadfast and immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. 1 Corinthians 15. And verse 58. And Sardis was a dead church. John said so. But that didn't excuse the individual members to do what they could do. In Revelation 3, 4, and 5, he said, "You have a few names even in Sardis who have not defiled their garments. And they shall walk with me in white. For they are worthy. He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will blot his name out from the book of life, and I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." Even in a dead church, there can be a few who wear robes of white and press on toward the prize and be what God would have them be. So, ladies and gentlemen, there it is. We got obstacles, problems, challenges, defeats in life that we can overcome and we can press toward the prize. Leonardo da Vinci and a barmaid. He became a painter, a sculptor, an architect, an engineer. He was said to be ahead of his time and was often ridiculed and rejected. But da Vinci once said this: "Obstacles cannot crush me. Every obstacle yields a strong resolve. He who is fixed to a star does not change his mind." And that's the way that we need to be as we press toward the prize. If you're using a songbook, turn to the number suggested. If not, it'll be on the PowerPoint. The Way of the Cross Leads Home. I want to close with one other little story since we're using the runner's analogy here of pressing toward the prize. It's a true story. There was a little girl that was born premature. Her name was Wilma. 4 pounds, 4.5 pounds. She was a 20th child of her father's 22 children from two marriages. She grew up in poverty in a nondescript little Tennessee town. She was an African-American girl growing up in the 50s. Life was tough for Wilma. She suffered, in addition to that, from a childhood illness, including pneumonia, scarlet fever. She contracted infantile paralysis caused by polio at age 5. She recovered from the polio, but she lost strength in her left leg and foot and wore braces for several years. In addition to that, if that wasn't enough, she contracted whooping cough, measles, and chicken pox. But through all that, Wilma determined to be a normal kid. Her brothers and sisters took turns every day massaging her crippled legs. Once a week, her mother, Blanche, who was a domestic worker, drove from their little town to Nashville, 90 miles round trip, to go to the therapy. Years and years and years of treatment, though, paid off. She eventually became a budding basketball star in high school. Soon she developed a love for running and eventually earned a scholarship in track for college. You probably remember her as Wilma Rudolph, the star of the 1960 Rome Olympics. She was billed at one time as the fastest woman in the world. She won the 100 and the 200 meters. She anchored the U.S. relay team in the 4x100 relay and broke all kinds of records along the way as the first American woman to win 3 gold medals in 1 Olympics. Wilma said this, "I ran and ran and ran every day. I acquired this sense of determination, the sense of spirit that I would never, never give up, no matter what else happened." And then Wilma Rudolph says, to be successful, you have to have confidence in yourself. And then she added, triumph cannot be had without struggle. Ladies and gentlemen, to reach forward spiritually and to press on toward the prize, we must imbibe that same spirit of determination to overcome whatever obstacle, whatever challenge, and whatever problem we encounter. I pray that we will. If you owe a duty tonight to God in some way, and we can lift you in prayer and help you, if you're struggling in some way, let us embrace you and help you on the road. If you're not a Christian tonight and you have become a child of God, and you've heard it preached and understand what it do to be a child of God through faith, repentance, and baptism, let us help you begin the Christian race and begin running and pressing toward the prize that God has in store for us. We can serve you. Would you come as we stand and while we stand?